This is an On the Media podcast extra. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, after the massacre in Orlando, Hillary Clinton renewed her call to the tech industry to help catch terrorists in the process of radicalization.
We have to do a better job intercepting ISIS's communications, tracking and analyzing social media posts, and mapping jihadist networks, as well as promoting credible voices who can provide alternatives to radicalization.
The same call went up after the San Bernardino shooting at the end of last year. And in January, a delegation of top U.S. officials, including FBI Director James Comey and Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson, met with the executives of Apple, Twitter, Facebook, and other tech companies to discuss battling terrorism online. One idea was an algorithm that could crawl social sites for signs of radicalization and assign people a risk value, like a credit score. The government would then, in theory, use that information to monitor the riskiest subjects. But is that legal? In January, Bob spoke to Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law.
So let's just say that the tech companies were able to put together some sort of algorithm that was actually quite good at crawling only the public spaces of the social web and somehow able to see the juxtaposition of certain words, whether it's jihad or explosives or broccoli, that gives a pretty good profile of intent to commit a terrorist act, let's just say. And some Joe Blow triggers the radicalization monitor. What could the companies and the government do with that high credit score legally?
That's a very good question. And this is related to issues that have been under debate legally ever since the Snowden revelations, if not before that, which is what exactly is the government and has the government been collecting? And so you're going to get a range of legal opinions on what they can collect. But the real question is here is what can they collect with a warrant and what can they collect without a warrant? And what they would have to do is show probable cause for some kind of criminal activity. If it were about foreign intelligence, it would be another kind of warrant. And then they could pursue some kind of investigation. Now, this is what goes on now when the FBI is trying to figure out who might be at risk of some kind of violent act.
It's really hard to imagine any sort of algorithmically generated score being useful in court to show the intention to commit a crime. But I can certainly see an FBI agent going to a judge and saying, look, you know, we've got this guy's scores. Not only should he not get a mortgage from anybody, but there's a high probability that he's very sympathetic to ISIS and the chatter is alarming. A judge saying, okay, you know, you may surveil him. You can have a warrant for that. How scrupulous do you think the judiciary will be in the face of what looks like a scientifically derived value?
I'm going to be an optimist about it. There's going to be a great deal of scrutiny about such a system. And let me say something about the courts and how they've dealt with individuals attracted to ISIS, which is somewhat different than how they've reacted to people accused of being associated with Al-Qaeda. There has been a sense that these are troubled youth, that they are often loners, that they are people who want to be terrorists but don't have the wherewithal, the means, the maturity. And I think that judges will take all of this into account and deal with it very carefully, with a sense of rehabilitation rather than using the criminal justice system as a hammer. I do think that the idea that there could be some kind of radicalization tendency score is really anathema to how we think about criminal justice, probable cause, innocent until proven guilty. And I think that's going to come up time and again in suits, and that judges will be receptive and open to that.
When I first read this story, I said to myself, Bob, I said, this doesn't sound like just a pipe dream of security hawks. It sounds to me like something the government's probably doing right now. Call me paranoid, but seems to me this is happening already.
Well, I'm not going to say that you're paranoid. I think there are reasons to be watchful and vigilant. I think the government in the past has been excessive in its use of surveillance authorities that many would argue it didn't legally have. But I think particularly in the wake of the Patriot Act's demise of Section 215 and the metadata program being declared illegal, there is tremendous force in this country from all different sides not to have warrantless surveillance or too broad a surveillance. Privacy concerns are spread across different constituencies in the United States. The one thing we have learned from this conversation with Silicon Valley and this idea of algorithms is that national security officials are not going to back down that easily from having powers such as that were conveyed by Section 215 of the Patriot Act taken away from them. But it's a robust debate, and it's not going to go down that easily.
I understand that the tech companies have historically been loath to hand over some of the data that the government has requested. However, they were at this powwow, and for whatever reason, maybe it's a patriotic duty, maybe it's a security duty, they seem to be on board with this. If corporations become an automatic conduit of personal information, what is a citizen to do?
I agree with you. The way this was reported in the media, it made it seem like the technology companies were very interesting in providing the service to the government. You can be sure that there is going to be a tremendous amount of pushback and challenge to any policy that's developed along these lines, whether it's transparent or secretive. But I want to underscore perhaps the reason that the technology companies would be leaning forward into this, which is that the belief in technology and what it can do may very well be overrated. And the idea that these algorithms could actually perform the kind of service that really needs to be performed by individuals with judgment, who have relationships with people, is something we're thinking about, as is the idea of false positives. This is going to be an awful lot of time and resource and a distraction when really what needs to be done is focused, interpersonal, reality-based, and not necessarily technology-driven understanding of what motivates people to take violent acts in the name of some kind of radical ideology.
Karen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. John Horgan is a professor of global studies and psychology at Georgia State University, where he studies terrorist behavior. He says that based on what we know about radicalization, the notion of a terrorist spotting algorithm is, quote, doomed to failure.
The simple reason is that radicalization is such a complex process. We really haven't developed the scientific basis for the kinds of questions that people are looking to answer right now. If there's one conclusion that has emerged from about 40 years of research, it's a story of diversity. We have lots of different people becoming involved in terrorism in lots of different kinds of ways.
You could probably say the same of those who are very bad at paying their bills or who are pedophiles. And yet, there is similar software out there scouring the web for signs of creditworthiness and so forth. Is that kind of technology not applicable to a radicalization detector?
Pedophilia and terrorism are quite different. I mean, there is no clear sense of what involvement in terrorism is. Depending on the jurisdiction in which you're looking, terrorism can involve everything from browsing radical sites to donating money to questionable charities to the far more extreme activity of wanting to go overseas to become a foreign fighter or constructing bombs. But the idea that we can somehow reduce all of this to something that can easily be measured, if not detected, is unusual to me.
We don't have the so-called semantic web yet, computers that actually understand language. But we do have a fairly evolved industry based on what's called sentiment analysis, which is used by companies to things as mundane as tracking their popularity of their brands online. Cannot such systems also at least begin to track radical sentiment?
it can certainly track radical sentiment, and it can possibly be used to track people who have an interest in exploring radical sentiment, but that will in no reliable way allow you to predict who is likely to become involved in terrorism. There is nothing wrong with being a radical. There's nothing wrong with holding radical views and in some cases expressing radical views, however inappropriate they might seem to you or me or anybody else. Research tells us that there are far more people who hold and who will profess radical views than will ever seek to become involved in terrorism. There are a lot of people who, for example, would classify themselves as ISIS supporters, and the beginning and the end of their involvement lies completely and exclusively online. That is all that they do. There is no desire for them to necessarily go and engage in real world activity. And to further confuse matters, there is increasing evidence to suggest that people who become involved in terrorism don't necessarily hold radical views, at least not to begin with. In many cases, we see people's radical views developing as a result of spending time in a terrorist group.
If there is a typical terrorist, is it someone who seethes for years or decades and then finally is moved to act? Or is it more often somebody who is just particularly predisposed to violence who gloms on to some sort of radical philosophy, perhaps at the last minute, in order to make his mark on the world?
It's all of that and more, Bob. I've interviewed members of Al-Qaeda, members of the IRA in Northern Ireland. I've interviewed young kids in Pakistan. Even within specific groups, there are multiple different pathways. Some become involved because they're motivated by the excitement, the glamour, the adventure, the romanticized notion they have. Others get involved simply because they're at the wrong place at the wrong time, and a family member is involved, a friend or a group of friends, and they simply find themselves going along. There are lots of examples of individuals I've interviewed who have said, well, I didn't realize why I became involved in this movement until, for example, I wound up in prison.
What should the United States government, with or without Silicon Valley's assistance, be focusing on to identify potential terrorists online?
Basic research to answer these common questions. I think we're all sick and tired of hearing academics such as myself saying, well, look, we don't know, there's no profile, and here is the diversity, but we don't really know what to do with it. We really need to start moving beyond that to be able to give firmer answers. But in the absence of funded research that is facilitated by access to better information, we're forever going to be in the dark here. I applaud the fact that the government is exploring these public-private partnerships, but the research community seems to be absent from these discussions, and that is worrying, to say the least.
I know you would like to see actual research into the psychology of terrorism, but I wonder if there's anything in these vast data troves of Facebook and Twitter and so forth that does interest you as a scientist and you think may have some value, if not for the creation of a terrorism detector.
Oh, I think there's extraordinary value. I mean, the reason why so many would-be jihadists and in many cases simply jihadist supporters are so deeply embedded in with their online world is because it has deep psychological and cultural meaning to them. We need to understand far more about what are the specific qualities of that material. Is it for personal consumption? Do they share it? But the social scientist in me really wants to understand the difference between those who consume this material and who go on to commit acts of terrorism versus those who just consume it for themselves. I know that most people would make a fairly plausible assumption that if you look at this material, if you spend time with it, then that somehow puts you at greater risk for becoming involved in terrorism. I don't buy that. It's an assumption. It's not something that is borne out by real life experience in many cases.
It's as if I spent my days playing Grand Theft Auto and police started targeting me because they think I'm a risk for creating mayhem and shooting civilians and police with automatic weapons.
Well, precisely, and that's a wonderful analogy. One of our researchers, Charlie Winter, discovered several senior female jihadis based in Syria complain to foreign supporters here in the United States to say to them, how dare you spend all of your time just engaging in social media? You need to get up off your backsides and come out here and join the fight. So when even ISIS themselves acknowledge that so many of their supporters begin and end their involvement online, then we know that we really need to proceed very, very carefully here if we think that we're somehow detecting terrorists.
John, many, many thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
John Horgan is a professor of global studies and psychology at Georgia State University.
You've been listening to an On the Media Podcast Extra. Just a quick reminder that we have deemed June Podcast Appreciation Month, and we would really appreciate it if you would text OTM to 69866. It takes just a few seconds to make a donation, and it will let us know that you support the work we do. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.